This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea in for Anthony Brooks.
Riddle me this. What's the latest tale of daring do to hit comic book stands?
Here's a hint. It doesn't feature masked Avengers or their earnest sidekicks.
There are no costumes, nor any secret lairs.
But the hero of this story does have an alter ego, or at least an alias.
What is it, you ask?
The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act to address our health care system's immediate and long-term challenges in a fiscally responsible manner.
Holy 1,900-page legislation, South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act? That's Obamacare.
That's right. The latest graphic novel to hit bookstore shelves tells the story of the Affordable Care Act, and it's titled Healthcare Reform: What It Is, Why It's Necessary, How It Works.
And its author isn't your typical comic book geek. No, author Jonathan Gruber is a geek of a different order. He's a healthcare economist.
Gruber was one of the architects of Massachusetts' groundbreaking healthcare reform law. He was also an advisor to President Barack Obama on the 2010 Affordable Care Act. He is an economics professor at MIT and the director of the healthcare program at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He joins us now in the studio. Jonathan Gruber, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here, Meghna.
So we're calling it a graphic novel, even though it's about a work of nonfiction, that being the National Healthcare Reform Act. But let me first ask you, healthcare reform as a comic strip, where did this idea come from?
It really came from the publisher who approached me because they'd had success in other mediums explaining things through graphic novel form. As the publisher said to me, look, when you're on an airplane and they want to make sure you're paying attention, what do? They give you a comic to show you what to do if the plane's going down. He said this is a great way for people to learn. I said, that's great, but I'm not interested. I hung up, and my son, who's a huge fan of graphic novels, said, Dad, you're completely wrong. This is a terrific medium. You've got to do it. And he convinced me, and I did it.
So he convinced you because is he of the target demographic you're trying to reach?
No. He just convinced me because he really was made a strong case this was a great medium through which to reach people.
Okay, so let's give listeners a little sense as to what the book is like. Again, I've got the title here. It's called Healthcare Reform: What It Is, Why It's Necessary, and How It Works. And in it, there are pictures of two-headed crocodile that represents the two prongs of America's healthcare challenge. There's you in a black tie and blazer with glasses and a big smile in almost every panel. There's a picture of a small infant with the phrase 2010, I believe, on its back because it's America's young reform efforts at healthcare. And there are typical Americans A, B, C, and D, Anthony, Betty, Carlos, and Dina, who sort of represent four different versions of healthcare Americans can have. So it's an interesting and compelling conceit, I have to say. But what did it take? Tell us a little bit of the process that it took for you to take your vast knowledge about the healthcare policy in America and turn it into a story with pictures, essentially.
Well, basically, the way it worked, Meghna, is I did an outline of everything I really wanted to cover in this book, and then I worked with H.P. Newquist, my co-author, on turning that into language that would really translate to the sort of comic bubble approach that's in the book. And then once we went back and forth, and once we had language we were happy with, we worked with the illustrator, Nathan Schreiber, to turn that into pictures that would convey the story.
You didn't have any concern through the process that putting it in a comic/graphic novel format might oversimplify or maybe even feel kind of trite when it comes to the truly enormous challenges that we're facing in this country regarding healthcare?
You know, I didn't. And I think really what motivated me to do this exercise, Meghna, is the poll numbers. You look at the poll number, you ask people, what do you think about the Affordable Care Act? And they say, I don't know, they're mixed, 50% like, 50% don't. Then you ask them, what do you think about not allowing insurance companies to discriminate? 80% like that. What do you think about limiting your out-of-pocket expenditures? 80% like that. When you describe what's in the bill, they like it. So I thought it actually would be great to be able to explain to people simply what is in this bill so they could say, oh, that makes sense. I do like that. We're in a rare situation in public policy, I think, where really education can really change people's opinion about a critical public policy topic. And I thought this was a great way to educate.
So in the book, what do you think is, I mean, there's a number of misunderstandings as you see them that you'd sort of tackle section by section in the book. You also talk about the story of Massachusetts' groundbreaking effort in healthcare reform, and I want to talk to you in more detail about that. But overall, what do you think is maybe the one or two most important misconceptions that people may have in more detail than you described with the poll there about the Affordable Care Act that you really hope to dispel through this book here?
I think there, if I had to list a couple, one would be, I think, the role of the individual mandate, which was so critical here in Massachusetts and is so critical nationally. I think people need to understand, this is one of the most complicated things we tried to convey in the book, is that the part of the bill that I think is the most important, which is ending the practices of insurers of discriminating against the sick, is so critical. People in Massachusetts don't realize this because we ended that in 1996 here. But in most states, if you're sick, you can be denied insurance coverage. When you get sick, you can be dropped from your insurance coverage. That is a critical failure in our social safety net in America. That will end. But it can only end if we ensure broad participation in the insurance pool, and that requires the individual mandate. So you ask people, the mandate by itself, it sounds scary. But when you explain to people how it fits in, or as I do in a picture in the book, show that it's the spinach you need to eat to get the dessert that's fairly priced insurance in America, I think that really explains why this is such a key part of healthcare reform.
And it's the one that at least currently is getting the most attention from political circles, and we'll talk to you about that. My guest is Dr. Jonathan Gruber. He's a professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He was also a key advisor to Governor Mitt Romney and then later President Barack Obama on both our local Massachusetts healthcare reform and national healthcare reform that was signed into law in 2010, the Affordable Health Care Act. He's put that story and his argument for the Affordable Health Care Act into a new graphic novel or a comic book form, and it's called Healthcare Reform: What It Is, Why It's Necessary, How It Works. So listeners, what are your questions for one of the key architects of the major reform that happened here in Massachusetts? What do you think should be done to improve the national healthcare bill, or what parts of it don't you like? And do you believe this idea that first you insure everybody, then you take care of costs when it comes to America's two-pronged problem with healthcare? Give us a call with your questions for Jonathan Gruber. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also at RadioBoston.org or online at Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Jonathan Gruber, I wanted to ask you about, there's a panel in the book where there's a picture of you standing in the background near a window, but in the foreground is a man signing a piece of paper over a desk, and that man, I presume, is Governor Romney. It's an image of when he signs Massachusetts' landmark healthcare reform into law. If you could take us back into that time, in the period that preceded the day of that signing, because I think due to the fact that Governor Romney is now running for president and he is actively backing away from his involvement in healthcare reform here in the Bay State, it brought to mind, like, what was the reality of how we got to where we are here in Massachusetts. So first of all, when Mitt Romney asked you to be one of his advisors on reforming healthcare, how did he ask you and what did you say?
Well, I mean, Mitt Romney, of course, himself didn't ask me. That's not the way government works. People who work for him asked me, and I'd been working with the state to help them understand alternative reforms to the healthcare system. And they said, we're thinking about really a radical overhaul of the healthcare system. We'd like you to help us put numbers behind that, help us understand what it's going to cost and how many people it's going to cover. So I was brought in to help with that. And we worked out a plan. In particular, a key role I played was to talk about how important the individual mandate was, to show that basically if you didn't have the individual mandate, you only covered about a third as many people while spending two-thirds of the money.
In fact, I mean, The New Yorker magazine this summer basically called you the man who convinced Romney that the mandate was essential.
I don't know if I can claim that much credit, but certainly I was the man who put the numbers behind it.
And when you presented him with those numbers first, what did he say?
I think he was impressed, and I think I was very impressed with him. He sat and really clearly believed this was the right thing to do. He clearly argued argued for it, and he believed in the individual mandate, I think partly because of my numbers, but partly just because of the principle of individuals shouldn't free ride on the system. He believed that very strongly.
I mean, in fact, I think you recall there was an actual meeting that you attended where Mitt Romney was debating his own advisors on this point, and he was the one arguing, I mean, after he'd heard from you, arguing quite passionately for the individual mandate. There's a quote again in The New Yorker of you remembering Governor Romney saying, "We've got to stop these free riders. We can cover all the uninsured without spending any new money." Can you take us back into that meeting? Like, really, how passionate was he about this issue?
You know, once again, that was my only big meeting with Mitt Romney, so I can't compare it. But I found him very passionate and very convinced. Once again, I don't want to overplay the role my numbers played in that. But he was really believed. He was excited like an engineer's excited about solving a problem. He was like, wow, here's a neat problem. Here's a neat solution we can have to a problem in the state. We can figure out a way to reallocate money we're already spending, or actually the federal government's largely already spending, to cover the uninsured in a way which will fix our broken insurance markets, cover the uninsured, and not have to raise taxes. We should do that. And his advisors were like, I don't know, this might not make so much sense politically. And he's like, no, it's the right thing to do. It's the right solution to an outstanding problem.
And now when you hear Mitt Romney on the national scene in the any number of recent debates we've had for the GOP presidential primary, when you hear him saying that really what they tried to do in Massachusetts was the spaghetti tactic, where take everything, throw it against the wall, see what sticks, how do you respond to that? And also, how do you respond to the fact that he seems to be basically, well, he explicitly says what's right for Massachusetts is not right for the rest of the country?
I mean, I'm mixed. On the one hand, I'm pleased that Governor Romney has not run away from what his clearly is his major accomplishment as governor of Massachusetts. On the other hand, he's trying to have it both ways, and he's just wrong. He's trying to have it both ways in two senses. First of all, he brags about the fact that he didn't have to raise taxes to get reform done, which is true, but it's only because the federal government paid for a lot of our reform, and the rest got paid for a tax that was already in place. So it's really misleading to say, oh, we didn't have to raise taxes and Obama does. That's not fair, because the federal government paid a lot of our bill. That's why we didn't have to pay taxes. Then the other thing he's saying that's misleading is it worked for Massachusetts, it won't work for the nation, but he never says why. In fact, it will work for the nation. There's no reason it wouldn't, except for the fact that at the national level, we have to raise money in a way that he didn't have to because the feds were paying for it.
During the time where you were hashing out the details of the reform here in Massachusetts, I know you said you've met with then Governor Romney, very infrequently. But did you get the sense from anybody in his circle of advisors or the people you were working with that there was a notion that what you were crafting in Massachusetts should be taken to the national level?
It wasn't really discussed, to my recollection. There was a huge belief in it, and there was an incredible excitement in his administration about really the innovative nature. I mean, we can't overemphasize the innovative nature, I mean, of what Mitt Romney brought, which is we were stuck between a left that wanted a single-payer health care system and a right which basically thought the system worked fine. Romney managed to figure out a way to come in and fix the system while leaving those who were happy with their insurance alone. And that hadn't been done before. And so it was incredibly innovative, and they were excited about it. But I don't remember him talking about the national applications.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Gruber. He's a professor of economics at MIT and one of the key advisors or architects of Massachusetts' healthcare reform plan. And he also advised President Barack Obama on the Affordable Care Act that was essentially our national health care reform. What are your questions for him? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've got several people who want to talk to you, Dr. Gruber, if I could.
Great.
Joe is calling from Somerville. You're on the air, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You mentioned that the things like banning pre-existing conditions and regulating the health care costs were popular. But then on the flip side is the individual mandate, which probably wasn't so popular. And I was wondering if there's a way that the federal government can regulate, ban pre-existing conditions, lower health care costs, without having the individual mandate.
Joe, that's a great question. Let me answer in two parts. First of all, in Massachusetts, actually, the overall health care reform, including the mandate, is quite popular. It's about 70% popularity, which shows to me when you put a plan like this in place, it can work and be successful with popular support. In terms of your question, which is a great one, which is, look, people like the chocolate, they don't like the spinach, can't we just drop the spinach? And the answer, unfortunately, is no. Because if you're going to tell insurers that they can't charge the sick more than the healthy, they're going to charge everyone as if they're sick. And if you don't believe me, it's not just economic theory. That actually happened in Massachusetts. In 1996, we passed a law which said insurers couldn't discriminate. You know what happened? Insurance premiums skyrocketed and our market shrunk enormously to the point where before Mitt Romney's reform in 2006, we had by far the highest non-group premiums in the country. So unfortunately, you can't have one without the other.
Jonathan Gruber, today the Supreme Court revealed new details about its much anticipated hearing that's going to happen early next year about the Affordable Care Act, specifically the individual mandate. And I've read you quoted as saying that you're frustrated that the future of the American health care system rests in the hands of one or two unelected people, justices, who might make the decision based on political grounds. That's a quotation from Capitol New York from the middle of November. First of all, tell me a little bit more about your concern on this front. And if, say, the Supreme Court does strike down the individual mandate, what effect would it have on the health care reform?
My concern arises from the fact that I don't believe there's actually a valid constitutional issue here. I think this has become, if you look at the decisions, the majority of the decisions from both Democratic and Republican judges have supported the individual mandate. The couple of decisions that haven't have been almost overtly political documents. One in Florida, for example, went out of their way to cite the Boston Tea Party as part of the case against the individual mandate. So I feel like the decisions against it have been really political, and I would just hope that that wouldn't be the nature of our judicial system. This should be decided really on legal grounds. On legal grounds, the case seems pretty solid from the experts I've talked to. If the individual mandate struck down, as I said to the last caller, that really puts the whole healthcare law at risk. Mm. It doesn't necessarily kill it. There are other pieces that could stay, but it makes it much less effective. Just to sort of give you a couple of numbers that I've estimated, if we keep the law in place without the individual mandate, we'll cover about a third as many people. That is, we'll cover about 10 million people instead of 30 million people. And premiums in the individual market will be 30% higher. So we really are going to vastly weaken this law without the mandate.
So in the new book, Healthcare Reform, What It Is, Why It's Necessary, How It Works, you use an analogy a couple of times where you say, well, anyone who wants to drive has to have driver's insurance. That's a government mandate. So therefore, it makes sense, or it shouldn't be such a surprise, that a healthcare mandate would be both effective and legal. But I wonder, I mean, some of the pushback against that is that you can opt not to drive and therefore not have to have driver's insurance. So therefore, but there's no similar option without penalty with the healthcare reform.
You know, and that's a good point. And this is a step beyond what the government's done in other spheres. The difference is healthcare reform is a place where there's a much stronger call for individual mandate than other sectors. One reason is, for example, that there's a law which states that hospitals have to treat you, even if you're uninsured. So if you have a law that says hospitals have to treat you even if you're uninsured, then people can just wait till they get sick and go to the hospital. So there's actually a right of society to make sure people don't just take advantage of that system by saying, if we're going to care for you once you're sick, we need to make sure you take care not to get sick and not to have those unpaid bills. It's also the case that the difference with healthcare is everyone at some point gets sick. Mm-hmm. Some people are bad drivers. Some people are good drivers. Some people never have an accident. Some people have lots. Everyone gets sick. Everyone needs medical care at some point. Everyone's in the system. You can't – people say, oh, I can't choose to not buy health insurance under this law. Well, you also can't choose not to get health care. Everyone gets health care. Since everyone has to rely on the system and draw on the system, we need to make sure everyone's part of the system and participating.
Let's take another call. Kate is calling from Waltham. You're on the air, Kate.
My question was, I wanted to know if the costs in Massachusetts for the state had gone down in terms of how much the state is spending on health care.
Kate, that's a great question. I think you have to look at two different sectors. If you look at the individual market, that is the minority of people who don't get insurance from their employer, premiums have come way down. They're actually about half what they were compared to national trends. It really is a striking fix of a very broken market. For employer premiums, they basically have grown at exactly the national rate. Because the truth is, this bill wasn't about cost control. This bill was about coverage, sort of unapologetically so. It was about two things, about fixing the broken non-group market, which we did, the premiums falling in half, and about covering the uninsured, which we did. We've covered about two-thirds of the uninsured. It was not about controlling the underlying trends in healthcare costs. And for that reason, they've gone at about the national trend. No faster, but no slower either.
Whereas in the national bill, cost control is a major goal.
Yeah, the national bill is really, you could think of the national bill as the Massachusetts bill but more ambitious along two dimensions. The first dimension is, as I mentioned, it has to get paid for. The Massachusetts bill got paid for largely by the feds. We didn't have to raise new taxes. The feds don't have that luxury. The second is the federal bill takes cost control much more seriously. That's been a goal from the start and a major goal of the bill, and there's a number of attempts to control healthcare costs in the bill.
I want to get to that in a little bit more detail, but before I run out of too much time, I want to sneak in another call in here. David is calling from Wenham. You're on the air, David.
Thank you. I've lived under the Australian system, the Canadian system, and for many, many years now, the American system. And the Canadian and the Australian systems are both single payer or dual payer systems. And I'm curious to see, did you study those? And which do you think would be the most cost effective if politics could be removed from the equation? A tall order, I know, but if that was so, which do you really think would produce the overall lowest total cost?
You know, I have to be honest, I don't know, because politics can't be taken out of the equation. I made a decision a number of years ago that I was going to focus my attention on healthcare within working within what was politically realistic and not really spend a lot of time trying to model things which are politically unrealistic. We just cannot have a single-payer system in America. First of all, most people are happy with what they have. The majority of people are happy with their employer-sponsored insurance. They wish it cost a little bit less, but you don't get very far in American politics by taking away something that 170 million people are happy with to help 50 million people who are unhappy. Second of all, you have an $800 billion a year private health insurance industry that we're just not going to nationalize. We just don't do that in America. We bail that industry smaller than that. We're not going to wipe out an industry of that size. So I think it's an interesting question and maybe something to worry about in 20 years, but it's just not in the cards right now.
Given the case that you can never take politics out of the equation, and you've just said that a single-payer system is untenable in the United States, I've also read you saying that if there are major provisions of the Affordable Care Act that are struck down, say, by the Supreme Court, that it's the last best hope for a free market solution covering the uninsured, and the only other option is to give up on the uninsured. I mean, that seems very stark. There's no middle ground.
You know, basically, I think that there is no middle ground. I think basically this is the best private sector option to covering the uninsured. I think if this goes down, you have two options. You can go to single payer, which, as I said, I don't see happening politically, or you can just let the number of uninsured go up. You can maybe work around the margins. We passed, for example, the CHIP bill in 1997. That covered a few million children. That was a great piece of legislation. But we have 50 million uninsured. And basically, there is no private sector alternative which can reach anywhere near this kind of level of effect.
Jonathan Gruber, we've only got about 3 minutes left. I just can't resist the urge to fantasize a little bit, because in the book Healthcare Reform, the new graphic novel that you have out, you state clearly that there are entrenched interests opposed to major reform in healthcare, the medical sector as a whole, even private employers who you'd think would want reform, but basically what they do is they pass the cost of increased premiums down to workers in the form of reduced wages. So you say that there's all the interests that would prevent real changes in, quote unquote, bending that cost curve down, getting a control on a rising healthcare cost. So let's just fantasize for literally 1 minute and say if those entrenched interests weren't there, what policies are there that would guarantee some short-term control on spiraling healthcare costs?
We don't know for sure. We have a lot of good ideas, things like accountable care organizations, which have been in the news a lot lately, comparative effectiveness research, which compares treatments and only pays for the most cost-effective one. These are all pretty good ideas, but we don't quite know what's going to work. And that's why what they do in the bill is try a bunch of things and see what works. And then we'll learn, and then we'll have round two, which is the real cost control we need. But that's a few years in the future.
Does that not seem even harder than what round one was?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why I'm saying people who say we shouldn't have done round one till round two are just saying we shouldn't have done round one. Round two is just it's going to take time.
So we're going to have round two here in Massachusetts, it seems likely, before it ever happens nationally, because this idea of the accountable care organizations, global payments where doctors get paid per patient versus fee for service, that all seems to be coming in a trickle, maybe soon a wave here in Massachusetts?
That is the hope, but it's very hard politics. There's a lot of entrenched interests, especially in Massachusetts, where the medical sector is so important. But I think there's been a lot of great thinking about this, a lot of people working on innovative solutions, and our state is the leader on coverage. I'd love our state to be leader on cost control as well.
I have to say, you have been as such a key player in the formation of our state and national policy on this, and I hear in your voice both a little hopefulness, but also frustration. I mean, do you genuinely worry that the steps that have been taken nationally, that we are at risk of undoing those? And if so, to what cost?
I am worried. I'm a worrier. It's my nature. But I think that I'm encouraged that in our nation, with our broken politics, we could achieve something as major as the Affordable Care Act. I just am hopeful that politicians won't undo this, partly because they just don't understand it. I hope they'll understand it and realize what we've accomplished.
Do you think that maybe supposedly the people who would seem as pro-healthcare Democrats, self-identified Democrats, even understand it themselves?
You know, that's one of my major audiences with this book, is I really think that Democrats should really like this bill. And I think when they understand it, they will.
Well, Jonathan Gruber, he's a professor of economics at MIT and author of the new graphic novel or comic book, Healthcare Reform, What It Is, Why It's Necessary, and How It Works. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
There's some images from the book at our website, by the way, radioboston.org. Do let us know what you think and what you heard from Dr. Gruber here today. Stay with us because coming up, do you shop online or in a local store? Now a new Amazon app tries to combine the two experiences. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Adam Ragusea today. This is Radio Boston.